Thank you, Your Honor. Appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Rod Jensen, Langdon Jorgensen of Robinson Waters and Adorcio, registration number 13302. The court's indicated that it's familiar with the facts in this case, so I'll spend very little time as far as going into the background. But in a nutshell, this case concerns the calculation of appropriate contributions for college expenses for the party's children, and also the appropriateness of an income assignment to try and collect unliquidated obligations. Under the separation agreement that the parties entered into, they agreed that any education costs over an amount that the parties were going to be funding would be shared by the parties on an equal basis. And they were basically contributing $100 per month, each parent, $50 for each child. The separation agreement was entered into, and this is important, on January 3rd, 1997. There were two subsequent amendments to the separation agreement. One was in August of 2007, when the appellant basically moved to Wyoming, which necessitated some changes in parenting time. And then another modification of the separation agreement in November of 2008, when Mr. Jensen's parenting time was adjusted somewhat. That's going to be important because the magistrate's perception that basically any changes to support obligations or to the separation agreement subsequent to July 1, 1997 meant that what we believe to be the governing statute is inapplicable. The separation on April 26, 2010, the parties arbitrated a number of child support issues with an arbitrator. And in the decision that was issued by the arbitrator on May 21st of 2010, the arbitrator addressed a dispute about the amount of college expenses that the children should be responsible for. The arbitrator determined that the language concerning college expenses in the separation agreement should be interpreted so that the children had no obligation to contribute to expenses unless the parties agreed. The arbitrator also held that the parties' contributions were not limited to the $100 per month. Each was contributing $50 for each child to their college accounts. That left a number of issues unresolved. It did not address what the appropriate amount of contributions from each parent should be. That issue was then presented to the magistrate in the proceeding appealed from. In that proceeding, it started out with Ms. Weiskopf filing a motion for an entry of judgment for what she considered to be appropriate higher education expenses. This included not just tuition, books, and fees, but also room, board, and other expenses. Mr. Jensen defended against that on the basis of arguing that the contributions obligations of both parents should be limited to the obligations, to the limits applicable under the statute at the time the separation agreement was entered into. Again, the separation agreement and college contribution agreement was entered into, and the decree was entered on June 3rd, 1997. And at that time, there were limitations on contributions that we'll discuss in a moment that we think should have been applied. The magistrate, however, found specifically that because the separation agreement was modified in some paragraph 12 of the decision, that since the support order is modified, was entered in this case, and again, as modified, was entered in this case on August 19th, 2007, which was when Mr. Jensen moved to Wyoming. The support order was established or modified after July 1, 1997. Now, we believe that the statute is clear. When the separation agreement and the child support obligations and the college contribution obligations were established by a separation agreement entered into before July 1st of 1997, we believe that CRS section 14.10.115, subsection 15 should govern. Under that statute.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Sir. It's certainly true, as you have said, that the initial separation agreement was entered into in June 1997.
Yes.
But you seem to not find significant that it was amended by the parties in August of 1997. I'm not quite sure why. I mean, in August of 1997, the parties modified the agreement, reaffirmed their commitments in the early agreement, even amended the section related to expenses of higher education in August 1997. Why does that not constitute an agreement to post-secondary education support after July 1997? I mean, the court also entered a decree in August of 1997. again, obviously after July 1997. Given all those facts, why wouldn't subsection 13 apply, as the magistrate found?
I think that there's two responses, Your Honor. The first response is that I think the term established, which is not defined by the statute, basically indicates when something started, something was founded, an obligation arose. The obligation to contribute to college expenses arose and became an order of court on June 3rd, 1997. And there's no case that indicates that simply when you modify a child support obligation, or in this case, modify a parenting time arrangement because of relocation of a parent, that it changes the establishment date for when the college expense or the original support order arose. So I think that from a matter of statutory construction, we have to look at when the original obligation was established. Secondly, under 1410.115, subsection 15A, which is the section that identifies what should, as far as the time frames, it indicates if the obligation was established before July 1, 1997, then basically subsection 15 applies. There is no provision of the statute under subsection 13 or any place else that indicates if it's subsequently modified that we don't apply subsection 15.
Well, since you're focusing on the statutory language, let me participate with you. In subsection 15, it says this subsection 15 shall not apply to child support orders established on or after July 1st, 1997.
Right.
In this case, there was a decree entered in August 1997, which adopted and entered as an order of the court the party's separation agreement as modified.
Right.
Why does that not constitute an order entered after July 1997?
Because there was an order entered before July 1st, 1997.
But how does that affect the character of the order entered in August 1997?
Your Honor, I think from a matter of statutory construction, again, looking at subsection 15A, that governs obligations that were entered before that time. Also, I'd like to maybe refer to the Chalet case, it's a Colorado Supreme Court case cited in the briefs. That's 112 P3rd 47, decided by the Supreme Court in 2005. In that particular case, what happened is that the parties agreed that they were going to contribute to, the father was going to pay for tuition, books, fees, room and board for the children to attend college through age 22. In 2000, after the 1997 statute was basically enacted and became effective, the husband then sought to file a motion to modify child support. Now, the last subsection of I think it's J under 1410.115, subsection 15, indicates that you can modify prior college support obligations. And it indicates that you can modify it from 1991 through 1997. The court in Chalet basically indicated that if you were trying to modify an obligation established before 91, then you had to show a change of circumstances. If it was after 91 through 97, then you simply applied the statute and that was sufficient grounds for modification. In that case, the court basically said in 2000 that a father basically satisfied the change of circumstances requirement for pre-91 obligations, then basically we would be applying the limitations under 1410.115, subsection 15. And so in that particular case...
Well, but in that case, the agreement was in 1993 and earlier. It wasn't after 1997.
You're correct, but the proceeding to modify was after 97 and 2000. And in that case, the court said that it would apply and be bound if he passed the change of circumstances threshold by the statute enacted in 97, 1410.115, subsection 15. So if basically past the change of circumstance threshold imposed for the prior to 91, I think is the actual language in the statute, if you pass the additional change of circumstances threshold established for those earlier obligations, then basically we'd still apply 1410.115, subsection 15. And I think that the clear meaning of the statute is that basically if you are going to, if the obligation was established were modified prior to July 1 of 97, then subsection 15 applies. And the court has already seen the briefs what those limitations are, so I won't belabor them.
No, it's interesting that, that you rely on Chalet, because, you know, I've spent some time studying Chalet, and it seems to me that it draws a distinction between orders for payment of post-secondary education imposed in the absence of an agreement between the parties and a private agreement that the parties enter into to pay for post-secondary educational expenses that is later adopted by the court as a decree. Chalet seems to suggest that where there's a private agreement between the parties, none of the restrictions of Subsection 15 apply. What would you say to that?
I believe, Your Honor, that Chalet specifically indicates that if the husband in that case, father, passes the additional threshold criteria of showing a change of circumstances, which is imposed for the agreements prior to 1991 under the statute, basically seeks a modification and obtains a modification, then it's going to be subject to the limitations under subsection 15 of the statute. So I believe that Chalet is revealing in that respect it applies directly. But there's an additional part that I need to try and address here. Your Honor, if we basically assume that subsection 13 applies for post-97, July 1, 97 actions, we have a problem here. The reason for that is there's nothing in the agreement that indicates that child support is going to continue beyond age 19. At least under subsection 15, it ends at 21. But there's nothing indicating in the agreement that it goes beyond age 19. So any kind of child support obligation should have ended at 19. Additionally, the court described its order in paragraph 13 as a modification proceeding. There's no indication that there was any kind of consideration of financial circumstances as required by CRS section 1410.115. In addition to that, there's no consideration given to how, in terms of how long the obligation is going to last. There's the court also, I think, if we're going to apply 13, basically indicated that because my client paid some post-secondary expenses, even though he disputed the education institutions the children attended, that was waiver as a matter of law, so that his disagreement with the choice should be disregarded. I don't think that that's sufficient to find waiver, even if we're applying subsection 13. The reason for it, there's coercive effect if you're trying to make payments and may be subject to contempt until the issue is resolved. Second of all, a parent may logically say, I disagree with the choice, I'll pay as much as if you were going to Metro or going to the community college living at home. But the extra expense, is not something I should contribute to. So a contribution to college doesn't mean that you should be bound to have waived any objection to the college you go to when you limit it to less than the amount that the other party would like you to contribute.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. You
yes, sir.
Tie much of your argument in your briefs to the argument that the term educational costs is used in the agreement. Should be defined in the same way as post-secondary educational support in section 1410.115.1g, right? Was that definition adopted before or after the agreement was entered into in 1997?
The statute was enacted before July 1, 97 with the July 1 effective date. The agreement was entered into obviously after enactment, if I'm answering your question.
Okay, so, but the parties, knowing that statute existed, the parties nonetheless chose not to use that term. They used a different term, right?
The parties were pro se, and I think they were trying to address a subject as opposed to trying to follow statutory definitions.
Why should we assume that when they use the term educational costs, they meant to limit it in the way that's defined in that statutory definition?
Your Honor, I believe that the statutory definition addresses the subject of continuation of basically dealing with contribution to college expenses. And that's the only statute that really addresses that. And I think that if they didn't track the exact language, I don't think that that's an intention that they didn't mean to be governed by existing law with knowledge of existing law. The other thing about it is that
the law is subject to agreement otherwise.
I'm sorry.
The law is subject to an agreement otherwise. Parties can agree the child can go to Yale if they want to and jointly make those payments.
Yes, I don't think there's anything in the agreement that indicates that they didn't intend to be bound by the law. The other thing about it is that there's no portion of the agreement that indicates that it goes beyond age 19, so the obligation would have ended by the time this proceeding went to hearing on it, because the daughter is now 22 years old. So, I mean, some definition at least would have been provided by the previous statute, which I think is effective when the agreement was entered into. But if it wasn't, then it should have ended at 19, because there's nothing that indicates it went beyond. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, if it pleases the court. Janice Whalen, registration number 22109, appearing on behalf of the appellee mother, Susan Weiskopf, formerly known as Susan Jensen. This case is about enforcement of a separation agreement between the parties. It raises two issues on appeal. The first issue is whether the lower court applied the proper statutory provision in entering a judgment in favor of appellee mother for post-secondary education expenses. The applicable law in this situation is under the child support guidelines, or child support statutory provision in 1410.115, subsection 13. The appellee agrees that the trial court applied the proper statutory provision in this case. There has been some question and some discussion this morning as to the specific dates and facts. Yes, the parties did enter into a separation agreement in June the 3rd of 1997, which was incorporated into their decree of dissolution on the same day. As the discussion has already revealed this morning, statutory provision was entered effective July 1, 1997, which limited, in part of its provision, limited the ability of the trial court to enter a child support post-secondary education order beyond that of tuition, books, and expenses. So the parties entered into their first agreement in June of 1997. As has been previously stated, the father appellant was moving to Wyoming, and so the parties entered a whole new agreement. They didn't change every single paragraph in their agreement, but they did go through and they republished their opinions. They re-signed it on August the 19th of 1997, clearly after the date of the revision of the statutory provision regarding post-secondary education. That order was then adopted by the court in September of 1997. As the court has discussed previously, 1410.113, subsection 13, states nothing in this revision, meaning the revision of the age of emancipation or in the limiting language regarding post-secondary education, shall preclude the parties from entering into an agreement extending the age of emancipation or for agreeing to pay post-secondary education expenses on or after July 1, 1997. The appellant relies very strongly on 1410.115, subsection 15, which gives us then the definition that limits the court as to what it can order. However, I would point out to the court that also in subsection 15, and I quote, this shall not apply to orders entered after July 1, 1997. Clearly the order entered after July 1 of 1997.
Excuse me, counsel. We've heard that the agreement was entered into in June 3rd of 97. Was there an order entered before July 1, 1997?
It was incorporated into their decree also on June 3rd, 1997.
Okay. Thank you.
And then
modified.
And then modified, and then that was re-entered as an order of the court in September of 1997, yes. So again, the appellee mother's position is that the lower court has applied the proper and correct statutory provision for enforcement and entry of a judgment. Yes.
May I interrupt you? Do you think that is dispositive of this case? What if we disagreed with you, for example, that subsection 13 applied versus subsection 15, or if we disagreed with you as to what date is important here, whether it's June date or the September date? Does that matter a great deal to your case, and if so, why?
I think it would bolster the appellant father's position that perhaps the court should be bound by the limitations set in subsection 15. However, upon reviewing the legislative history and also the provisions of subsection 15, those limitations apply to an order that the trial court can enter on its own, not necessarily an agreement of the parties. But I don't think we have to go there, Your Honor, because the legislation, the legislators and the General Assembly were very clear that after this date, the parties can enter into an agreement to cover these other expenses. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no other questions regarding the first issue, then I would go to the second issue that was raised on appeal, and that is whether or not the lower court had the authority to enter an order for wage assignment. Post-secondary education is clearly in the nature of child support. We know that because it's covered under the child support statute. We also know that actually from the case of In Re Marriage of Shalott, which has been mentioned in both briefs, that says it was a strictly defined portion of child support. So therefore it is in the nature of child support. Pursuant to 1410.111.5 subsection E subsection F, whenever the court orders and enters an order for child support, it shall be ordered by the court to be activated by a wage assignment. A wage assignment is actually reviewing 1115.5 is a default mechanism because it says unless agreed otherwise by the parties. These parties did not agree otherwise. So therefore, it was proper and appropriate to enter a wage assignment in this case.
Counsel, can you answer a question for me? The statute on income assignment provides that when you determine an obligation for child support, when you initially determine it, the amount of child support shall be ordered by the court. Here, you don't have an actual amount until there's a reconciliation. Doesn't that create a problem?
That creates a little bit of, if you will, a sticky wicket as to how do we look at a child support order. In this case, the court looked at, and all the court could look at, were the expenses that had already been paid for the child's education, and then annualized that going forward over the next year, because the court actually did annualize it. The court did not break it down by semesters. And when one thinks about a child support obligation in general, it is an annualization going forward. We find the people where they are today and apply the guidelines and come up with what would be the appropriate monthly support obligation. What the court did in this case was recognized, I believe, the fact that there could be changes going forward, and therefore provided an opportunity for reconciliation of the books at the beginning of each semester. I would also call to the court's attention that the September 2010 arbitration award specifically stated that mother would submit the bills for the upcoming semester. So the semester starting in January, mother would have those bills by December. She wouldn't know what the costs would be going forward. That she would submit those to father, who would then pay within 10 days of submission of the bills. What happened, and what happened repeatedly, which brought this before the trial court, was that there was a failure to pay the full amount of the bills. Father elected to only pay tuition fees and costs. So mother was complying with the arbitrator's order, which was confirmed by the trial court. And it did provide a mechanism going forward. It annualized the amounts, and it also gave an extra safeguard of reconciliation.
It seems to me, following up on Judge Casebolt's question, is this kind of sort of indeterminate estimate of what the college expenses may be in the future is quite different from a some certain child support amount that's going to be due every month into the future until the order is modified. For example, let's say the child support obligation is $1,000 a month until a child is emancipated. That's clear. The father or the mother, whoever is obligated to pay support, has to pay $1,000 every month into the future. Here, it may not be $1,000. It may not be the $833. It may be less than that if, for example, the expenses are less. So in that scenario, there would have been an income assignment for amounts the father was never actually obligated to pay. Do you have any authority for using the income assignment statute in that way?
I could not find any actual legislative authority or case law on point. The closest case to that, as I referenced in my brief, is in re the marriage of Paddock, I believe it's Paddock, where an income assignment was ordered. It also dealt with post-secondary education expenses. But the trial court ordered that the husband, father, would have to pay a percentage of the expenses going forward. It was remanded back to the trial court to come up with a dollar amount specific. So that was the closest case I could find as an authority on that issue, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that case suggest the magistrate's order here is incorrect?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't that case, the Pollock case, is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Wouldn't that case suggest the magistrate here committed an error?
Because
there was not a some certain date. It's $833 estimate, which could be changed every semester, which is not the same as Pollock.
Agree. I agree that the distinguishing factor, I think, between Pollock and this case was that in Pollock they were dealing with percentages as opposed to a dollar amount. Here the lower court said, based on the facts available to me, this is the dollar amount that will be paid going forward. I think, if I may just throw out there for consideration, that there could be an argument, well, why doesn't the appellant father get to keep these funds in his Schwab account and get interest on it? Why does mother have the control of it? And I think that it is being funded into the children's education account that the parties had established. Yes, father may lose some interest, and so is there some equity argument there, perhaps. But the other part of that equity argument is, should mother always have to resort to either arbitration, entry of judgment, or seeking a contempt in order to get her payments when they're due? So she, likewise, is losing the benefit of the money. She's paying the full amount at the beginning of the semester and then waiting.
Wasn't there a remedy for that by virtue of awarding attorney fees if the mother has to seek collection of a judgment constantly every 6 months, 12 months, whatever?
Your Honor, there is that remedy. To have to always go back to court every 6 months, I think would be very laborsome for the mother. I think we also have history in this case and on the record on appeal of father's history of failure to comply with court orders. Father was at one point issued to post a $500 bond with the district court for failure to comply with parenting orders. He was found in contempt at one point. And the issue of payment in a timely fashion was also addressed in arbitration and then finally had to come forward for hearing before the magistrate. So yes, there is a remedy, but certainly very burdensome on the appellee mother.
Do you have a question? I'm following up on that. Could the magistrate have achieved something similar to what was attempted here through a slightly different manner? For example, could the magistrate, based on the evidence presented, have come up with a figure for what future college expenses will be? I mean, it's an estimate, like most child support obligations are, and say, based on the past, I'm going to estimate it's going to be $800 a month for the next 5 years. I'm going to order an income assignment of $800 a month from the father for the next 5 years. There's not going to be any further reconciliation. If the amounts are less, then that the amount's going to stay the same. It's going to be $800. If the amounts are more, again, the amount's going to be $800. It's not going to be any change, just like a regular child support obligation. But it's not subject to fluctuation or reconciliation. Could the magistrate have done that? And was that discussed at all?
That was not discussed at all. The magistrate wanted to know what the costs were and divided it in half and then annualized the father's obligation going forward. Could the magistrate have ordered that going forward? I suppose so, but I think the magistrate was looking at the equity of the situation, quite frankly, and saying, in case this is too much or too little, let's reconcile these books. Let's make it right. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
It sounds like the magistrate could do exactly that, but the problem is making it an income assignment, isn't it? The problem is saying there's an uncertain amount. How do you make an income assignment for an uncertain amount?
Well, the magistrate did order the 833. That is a certain amount for an income assignment. And then mother could simply, if it was an overpayment, repay the father. So I guess it is going forward at the 833 with the mechanism for mom to not enrich herself through it. I see my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you an opinion in due course.